Laughing to crying to laughing. Doing sketch comedy on live television while pregnant is like wearing a sombrero. You can pretend to be a serious person, but the giant hat gives you away. I have spent an inordinate amount of time on camera being pregnant. Sometimes it was real, and sometimes it was not. When I shot the film Baby Mama, I wore a fake belly. It was shaped like a watermelon cut in half, and it was strapped onto my body with flesh-colored Velcro. I would adjust it to where it felt comfortable and then giggle at the sight of it under my clothes. I would rip my belly off at lunch, and the satisfying Velcro rip would announce that my pregnancy was over. Many times I patted my sweaty and firm stomach and thought about how cool it was going to be when I really was pregnant. Real pregnancy is different. I always wanted to have kids. I like them. They like me. I'm a mother now, and I think I'm pretty good at it. I think I'm a decent person and a very good listener and excellent at funny faces, all necessary when mothering a child. When I was 26, a Japanese healer felt my abdomen and told me I had a joyful uterus and I would have 3 children. He worked in a dusty office that smelled like envelope glue. He gave me a bunch of herbs to help with my anxiety, which is why I was actually there. But when I boiled the herbs, the smell was so horrible that I became instantly anxious at the thought of ingesting them and threw them in the garbage. In addition to my joyful uterus, I have what my Nana referred to as her Irish stomach. This means that when I get old, I should limit myself to buttered saltine crackers and the occasional hot dog. I associate hot dogs with the very young and the very old. Once, after a grueling rehearsal at SNL for a Mother's Day show, where I was 6 months pregnant with my second son, I asked the indefatigable Betty White what she was going to do when she got home. She told me she was going to fix herself a vodka on the rocks and eat a cold hot dog. In one sentence, she proved my theory and made me excited for my own future. Most of my 30s were spent married and without children, which is a state of affairs that I would highly recommend most people try for a while. Married and without children means you can go on vacations with other childless couples. You can eat in any restaurant at any time and have conversations about interesting things. You can decide to learn how to surf or write a slim book on the best place to buy a fedora in Los Angeles because your spouse will be supportive and no one has to go home to relieve the babysitter. I was in no rush to change this wonderful lifestyle. Then I woke up and realized I was 37 and might need to get cracking. Pregnancy is such a sensitive and subjective experience. Trying to get pregnant is the most vulnerable thing in the world. You have to openly decide you are ready. And then you have to put sperm in your vagina and elevate your legs like you're an upside-down coffee table. It's all ridiculous and incredibly sci-fi. Everyone's journey is different, and I have nothing to say about how and when someone decides to become a mother. The legacy of my generation will be that we have truly expanded the idea of what family means. It is no longer unusual for people who choose surrogacy, gay adoption, IVF, international and domestic adoption, fostering, and childlessness to live side by side and quietly judge each other. We can all live in peace, thinking our way is the best way and everything else is cuckoo. I was lucky. I tried for a little while to get pregnant, and at 37, I did. I didn't tell anyone at first, as you are supposed to keep it secret. It's a really magical time, those first few weeks. It almost makes you wish you didn't have to tell anyone ever. You could just watch your belly grow bigger, and no one would be allowed to ask you about it, and you would have your baby, and a year later, you would allow visitors to finally come and meet your little miracle. I was halfway through my 7th season at SNL, and no one really noticed my nausea or extreme tiredness. This was par for the course at a job that made you stay up all night long and eat cold mozzarella sticks you had to buy yourself. My OBGYN was a wonderfully old Italian man I will call Dr. G. Dr. G had delivered Sophia Loren's children. I know this because everyone from his receptionist to the other doctors in his practice liked to tell me this fact. I was happy to hear that Dr. G was comfortable with beautiful and famous vaginas. I don't consider myself beautiful or famous, but my vagina certainly is. Everyone knows this. I have the Angelina Jolie of vaginas. And there is your pull quote, editors. But even with my glamorous vagina, I worried about delivery. I have many friends who have had natural childbirth. I applaud them. I have friends who have used doulas and birthing balls and pushed out babies in tubs and taxi cabs. I have a friend who had two babies at home, in bed. Her name is Maya Rudolph. She's a goddamn baby champion, and she pushed her cuties out Little House in the Prairie style. Good for her. Not for me. That is the motto women should constantly repeat over and over again. Good for her, not for me. I knew early on that my big-headed babies were going to be tricky to get out of my 5-foot-2-inch frame. I knew that I was worried about pain and wanted to have the right measures in place. I knew I was the kind of person who could barely go to the movies without being stoned, let alone a delivery room. I remember a very important day when I told my dentist I wanted nitrous oxide at the ready every time I came in for an appointment. No matter the procedure, no questions asked. This is what adults do. They demand or deny drugs on their own terms. Luckily, Dr. G made me feel like I'd be able to handle anything. Dr. G was European and old-fashioned in all the right ways. He reassured me I didn't need an amniocentesis by reminding me that Italian women don't worry about that sort of thing. I imagined Sophia Loren laughing off the idea of a needle being driven into her pregnant belly as she sipped an espresso. Dr. G dressed in stylish suits and moved very gently, squirting cold gel on my tummy while whistling a slow tune. He didn't have a 3D imaging machine. He had a utilitarian black-and-white deal that showed you a blurry picture of what looked like a big-headed frog. "Your baby is very smart," he would say to me and my husband, Will Arnett. "You are doing everything right. Please drink 1 or 2 glasses of wine at night." I was so lucky to have Dr. G as my doctor. I didn't feel neurotic or stressed. I felt like a success. I ate what I wanted, and I felt super sexy. I was lucid enough to realize that I was on a total hormonal high, and that a crash was just around the corner, but I didn't care. I loved being pregnant. I loved being at work and still feeling vital and busy while this extraordinary thing was happening inside of me. I never felt alone. I always had a companion. I reveled in all the new space I was taking up. When your stomach is big, you knock things over and everyone stays out of your way. I was big in brand new ways and I felt very powerful and womanly. I couldn't have chosen a better doctor to deliver my first child. Unfortunately, that never happened. Dr. G died the day before I went into labor. Yep. But before I get to that, the last week of SNL, before my son Archie arrived, was incredibly exciting. The 2008 presidential race was almost a dead heat, and the entire year leading up to the election had been a magical time to work on a live, satirical sketch comedy show. Everything felt electric. The audience knew the ins and outs of every political story, and a lot of it had to do with what Saturday Night Live was doing. I think everyone was crushing it that season, and the show had never been better. We could barely keep up with the daily goodies and produced 4 primetime Weekend Update Thursday specials during September and October. I was 8 months pregnant and did 15 live shows in 13 weeks. Everyone came on. I met then-presidential candidate Barack Obama while I was dressed as Dennis Kucinich. Maya was dressed as Barack Obama at the time, so the introduction might have been slightly more embarrassing for her. We were doing a sketch about how hot Kucinich's wife was. That's how much America was paying attention. Then Tina played Sarah Palin for the first time and blew the roof off the joint. The anticipation of Tina playing Palin was so fun to witness, and she explains it well in her book, 50 Shades of Grey. She totally took on what was expected of her, and it was awesome to stand next to her as she killed. The sketch that night dealt with Hillary Clinton coming to terms with Vice Presidential Candidate Sarah Palin. It dealt with fierce competitiveness in politics. It dealt with power and entitlement. It dealt with the way society forces women to define themselves and compete against each other. It tackled old theories about Madonna versus whore and slut versus shrew. But most importantly, it was really funny. That sketch was written by Seth Meyers. Tina and I added jokes. SNL and now Late Show with Seth Meyers producer Mike Shoemaker wrote the legendary line, "I can see Russia from my house." I remember standing on stage and it being one of the few times that something felt perfectly whole. Archie did flips in my stomach each time the audience clapped. It was the closest to what I imagine it feels like to write a hit song. My stomach grew bigger and the election grew closer. With just a few weeks left, Governor Sarah Palin was asked to come on the show. I'd never met her, but many years before, I had met Senator John McCain when he hosted and liked him instantly. We did a scene in a shower together, and he was totally appropriate while also being very pleased. He was vigorous and honest. He noticed me smoking and told me if he knew the world was going to end, the first thing he would do is start smoking again. He invited me to his house in Arizona. We hit it off. I knew Tina would do a great opening sketch with Sarah Palin, and Seth and I were trying to think of something to do with her at the update desk. I think I made some sort of joke about getting her to do a hardcore rap or something. Then I laughed at the thought of doing one right near her in the gigantic state that I was in. Seth laughed too. I mean, it certainly wasn't some wildly original idea, but as usual at SNL, the time pressure lets us do things without overthinking. When you're pregnant, you can get away with a lot of shit. Women really are their most dangerous during this time. Your hormones are telling you that you're strong and sexy, everyone's scared of you, and you have a built-in sidekick who might come out at any minute. There should be some kind of pregnancy superhero movie. Calling Hollywood now. What's that, Hollywood? It's a weird idea, and also you don't do movies with female superheroes? Okay, copy that. I went into my dressing room and wrote the rap. Seth helped. Andy Samberg helped. I met Palin in her dressing room beforehand to go over things, and I was honestly surprised that they didn't make us change more of it. She and her team only wanted to modify a small joke about Todd being a real ladies' man or something, I think. Her daughter Bristol was pregnant at the time, and we made small talk about babies. I did the rap, and it was super fun. My stomach looked so big, it almost seemed fake. It was ridiculous. I was so tired between dress and air that I remember lying in my dressing room like a bear and sleeping deeply in between sketches. Which brings us to Friday, October 24th, 2008, the day I went into labor, the day after my doctor died. The musical guest that week was Coldplay, and it was going to be John Hamm's first time hosting the show. I'd been working the whole time and feeling pretty good, exhausted, yes, but invigorated. And honestly, at the end of a pregnancy, any lady will tell you she's searching for anything to take her mind off the creature that is about to burst forth. So I had done my rap the previous Saturday and slept all day Sunday feeling happy. Will and I had our suitcases packed and a name picked out. We were both so happy and so in love. Nothing brings a couple closer than a baby about to arrive. Each person needs the other so desperately and in such new and deep ways. Each day through the week, I was doing my check-in with the doctor. As we all know, a watched cervix never dilates, and I'd still been tight and sassy that Thursday morning. Dr. G assured me that I would probably deliver a few days late, like most new mothers. I told him I was going to do the show on Saturday, even though it was technically my due date, but any time after that would be fine. It was the first of many times I ridiculously thought I had any control over my schedule, this baby, or life and death in general. I was in the middle of rehearsing a Mad Men parody Friday morning and called to confirm my 3 p.m. appointment. The receptionist answered the phone crying. She told me Dr. G had passed away from a heart attack in his sleep. I burst into tears so loudly and violently that I think water was squirting out of my eyes, like in a Kathy cartoon. Nothing is more horrifying than a giant pregnant lady sobbing. Everyone got very quiet. I hung up the phone and I told John and the hair and makeup people that my doctor had just died. And I was due tomorrow. And then I knew it seemed like a weird punchline, but my beloved and dear Italian grandpa was not going to be able to help me. I felt so terrible about the fact that all I was thinking was, what about me? I cried and cried in my Mad Men dress. John Hamm held me by the shoulders and looked at me and said, I know this is very sad, but this is a really important show for me, so I'm going to need you to get your shit together. This made me laugh so hard, I think I peed. Going from crying to laughing that fast and hard happens maybe 5 times in your life, and that extreme right turn is the reason why we are alive. And I believe it extends our life by many years. I told everyone at dress rehearsal. It freaked them out. At 3 p.m., I went to Dr. G's office and was met by his grieving colleagues who had worked with him for decades. One of them, the lovely Dr. B, examined me and told me I shouldn't worry. Nothing was happening and I would probably deliver a few days late. He had already treated and met with Dr. G's other patients and would spend the next 24 hours delivering 5 babies. He was kind and professional, but it was extremely weird. He was a stranger. I went back to SNL, where I stayed until 2 a.m. Maya and Fred Armisen were doing bits on the main stage, pretending to be robot versions of themselves. And I laughed, and I laughed, and for the millionth time, I thought about how lucky I was. Eddie, the security guard, walked me to my car and asked me how I was doing. "I'm tired," I said. I went home and got into bed. It was 3:30 in the morning. I put on my favorite TV show, Law & Order, to go to sleep. I heard the bum-bum sound effect in the opening credits, and my water broke. Do you know when your water breaks, the best thing to do is stand up? Your baby acts like a plug. Isn't that insane? Strange thoughts like this and others filled my head as Will and I tenderly got ready to go to the hospital. I had that nervy feeling you get when you know your whole life is going to change and you realize you're made of tissue paper at the same time. Will raced around and I weirdly brushed my teeth. And as we got our car from the garage, our doorman predicted we were going to have a girl. I sat down in Will's car and gushed all over it. I was worried that he would be upset, but he laughed as he helped me in. I looked at him and I thought, I've turned into an animal now, and I have a feeling this will be the nicest thing you see all night. I took drugs and pushed. It was hard and long. I texted Shoemaker and Seth and told them I wouldn't be coming to work. While I tried to get my little bugger out, SNL scrambled to replace my parts. The real Elizabeth Moss came in to play herself, and she met Fred Armisen, who 1 year later, to the day, would become her husband. I would go to their wedding on my 1-year-old boy Archie's birthday. Seth Meyers prepared to do Update alone for the first time. He would go on to do it alone successfully for years, although I like to think it was a tiny bit less fun. My big-headed wonder couldn't get out, and I started thinking crazy thoughts. What if this was the one baby they couldn't get out? What if they just handed me back my clothes and sent me home and said, "We are so sorry. We did what we could, but we just couldn't get him out. We wish you the best." I felt like the bouncer of my own uterus. I was ready to turn on all the lights and kick that baby out. Time to wrap it up. I don't care where you go, but you can't stay here. I finally had a C-section. As I was wheeled into the operating room, one of the nurses said, "Hey, it's Hillary Clinton," and I answered by barfing all over her. Full circle. Archie was born Saturday, October 25th at 6:09 p.m., just about when we would have been getting ready to do our first run-through for Weekend Update. He was, and remains, perfect. My whole world cracked open and has thankfully never been the same since. I watched Saturday Night Live that night, drugged to the gills. I watched scenes that I had rehearsed hours before. I watched Maya and Keenan sing a song to me, and Seth tap my spot at the update desk and tell me they loved me. I sobbed and sobbed, and then I laughed and laughed. I added a few more years to my life. I kissed Archie's giant head, which was shaped like a beautiful balloon. Today we wear the same size sombrero. He is 6. Well, I'm excited to introduce another guest who's joining me here in my personal audio booth, Seth Meyers.
Hi, Amy.
Hi, how's it going?
It's going great. Thank you for having me in your booth.
Oh, well, it's, you know, I built it many years ago, before I had even written a book.
You can see your handiwork all over it.
Yeah.
Exposed nails. Wide open spaces between slats of wood.
Yeah. I didn't really use any blueprints, and I fear the sound isn't going to be very good.
Well, you have an improv construction company that is very unpopular with its customers.
Right. A lot of object work, but no actual wood.
No physical objects.
Yeah. Now, Seth was nice enough a while ago to offer to write something for my book, And then I had to call him and tell him, remember that thing that you said you were going to do? Now you have to do it.
Yeah. But I did say it and I did do it.
You did do it. You really did do it. And so you're going to read the chapter that you wrote for my book, Yes, Please. And then does this mean that I will have to write a chapter for your book?
Yeah. If I ever write a book, you definitely have to write a chapter
for me. Oh, you, Seth, you gotta write a book.
Oh, I can't. I don't want to because you complained about writing this one so much.
It's terrible.
It's so terrible.
But are you having fun in the studio party with all the people that are here?
It's so great. I just talked to Patrick for about an hour. So lovely.
Yes.
I'm sorry. Is it rude to say that we kind of went into our own conversation while you were reading your chapters?
I did hear you guys chatting while I was reading, but it's just the nice sound of friends.
Your audio guy said he could scrub all that out.
Yeah, he said that with fear in his eyes, because I don't think we're going to be able to do that. But it's okay. I'm glad you're having a good time while I read my book.
It's great. There could be a little more wine.
Okay, sure. I mean, you know, that's always the case, I guess.
Yeah, one bottle for the group.
W-I-N-E, not W-H-I-N-E.
Yeah.
Because that would affect my performance.
Oh, there'll be plenty of W-H-I-N-E in my read, in my nasally reading voice.
Oh, should we let people know that you're reading with a broken nose?
I am reading with a broken nose that I only broke 3 days ago.
Ugh. By the time this audiobook comes out, you'll have your new nose.
I'll have my new
Everyone
nose.
Everyone will buy that story that you broke it playing street
that
hockey.
Story. I went away for a weekend and got a brand new nose.
You know what they say when you get plastic surgery? You should change the color of your hair.
Really? To distract from the nose?
Yep.
You know what I did instead? I got a new talk show set.
Perfect.
I timed it out with a brand new set.
That really is a great way to distract from the work that you've gotten done. You can't see where because this is audio, but right now Seth is covered in bandages.
I like that you had to tell whoever's listening this is audio. They were wondering why they couldn't see it until you pointed out it was just audio.
You know, it's this kind of bullshit that I need to take from you every day that makes me feel really good that I made you write a chapter for this book. So without further ado, Seth, are you ready to read your chapter?
Yes.
Don't screw it up.
Great.
Okay, and I'm going to step out of the booth and stand on the other side of the glass and
okay, so I'll wait for you to exit, and then once we lock eyes, I'll start.
Okay, here I go. Bye, so I'll see you later.
Oh, wait, no, I'd still be full volume. Bye, Amy.
Bye, I'm going to go down the hallway.
Okay, great.
Slam. Door. Vroom,
vroom, vroom, hey, where's she going? Vroom, wait a second.
Okay, take it away.
Hello, everyone. My name is Seth Myers, and I will be reading this next chapter that I wrote so that Amy can take a break. It is very hard to write a book. I haven't written one myself, but I know it's very hard because every time I have seen Amy in the past year, she has greeted me by saying hello, quickly followed by, it is very hard to write a book. At one of these meetups, I offered to write a chapter for her so she could rest. She said yes, please. After I complete this favor for Amy, I will only owe her 1,000 more favors. I am not unique in my great debt to her. Most of Amy's friends owe her around 1,000 favors. She never holds it over you, though. She's not that kind of person. I'm going to tell you about the night that Amy gave birth to her first son, Archie. Before I get there, a bit of background. I first saw Amy Poehler perform in Chicago at a theater called Improv Olympic in the mid-90s. That theater is now called I.O. because the Olympics threatened to sue. The International Olympic Committee was worried people would walk into a 100-seat theater on the corner of Clark and Addison and wonder why no one was jumping over hurdles. The night I first saw Amy, she and the other performers were playing an improv game called The Dream. She asked for a volunteer to come on stage and tell her about their day. I raised my hand and she picked me. My first conversation with Amy was in front of an audience, me in a chair, her standing beside me. She was charming, funny, sweet, and sharp, and I left thinking, I would like to be her friend. The next time I saw Amy perform was with Tina Fey in the same theater. They were workshopping a show called Women of Color. I would later learn that it was the only performance of that show. Amy would move to New York soon after, and Tina would quickly follow. There weren't a lot of people in the audience that night, and for a while, I thought seeing Amy and Tina perform in Chicago right before they left and got famous would be the most interesting thing that ever happened to me. In my mind, it was like seeing the Beatles in Hamburg. And much, I'm sure, like someone who saw the Beatles in Hamburg, I talked about it so much that my friends eventually said, genug. At this point, my relationship to Amy was the same as everyone else's. I was a fan. I auditioned for SNL in 2001. My manager called to tell me I'd been hired. He then listed the other new cast members, one of whom was Amy. My first thought after hanging up the phone wasn't, oh my God, I'm going to be on SNL. It was, oh my God, I might get to be friends with Amy Poehler. I'm happy to say we were friends right away. I won't bore you with the details of our many years of friendship and collaboration on the show, for no other reason than it is likely Amy has dedicated dozens of pages to that topic in this very book. I wouldn't be surprised if a photo of me graces the cover of this book. To take up any more time talking about it would be redundant. Instead, I will pick up the action years later on a Saturday before the Saturday Amy became a mother. Josh Brolin was hosting the show that week, but this fact would soon be rendered a footnote when Sarah Palin agreed to do a cameo. In 2008, under intense pressure from the comedians' lobby, Senator John McCain selected Alaska Governor Sarah Palin as his running mate. This brought much good fortune to SNL in the form of Tina Fey's mimicry. However, the fact that Governor Palin would actually be appearing on the show was not immediately greeted with cheers. It wasn't that we weren't excited to have her on. We just didn't know what to do with her when she got there. When you perform a sketch about a person when they're not in the room, you have a great deal more freedom than when they are in the room. It was understood that we'd have to write a sketch with Tina and the governor, and we did. It was a soup of moving parts. Alec Baldwin, Lorne, and Mark Wahlberg made cameos. There were some jokes, and it went well. Sensing that the audience might want more, on Friday night, Lorne suggested using Governor Palin a second time on Weekend Update. We sat in our weekly joke read, kicking around ideas that failed to inspire any enthusiasm. For a laugh, someone said the governor could do a rap, perhaps starting with the line, "I'm Sarah Palin, and I'm here to say." Someone else suggested that the governor could get cold feet and Amy could do the rap instead. I don't remember if either of these ideas was meant to be real, but I do remember that Amy's eyes went wide with glee and she left the room with a notebook in her hand. The next time I saw her, she was on the phone with the wardrobe department, barking orders like mission control trying to get a shuttle back. "I need Eskimo suits for Fred and Andy, a snowmobile suit for Jason, and a moose suit for Bobby." Take a second here. Go back and watch the Palin rap one more time. Maybe you forgot how convincing and believable Sarah Palin was when she said she wasn't going to do the piece. Maybe you forgot exactly how pregnant Amy was when she stood up from behind the desk. You probably remember that Amy was good, but you likely forget exactly how good. It's a performance without artifice. She's not play rapping, she's rapping. I still get goosebumps when I think of Amy screaming, "I'm an animal and I'm bigger than you." And the whole time she was doing it, for every single second of it, there was a little person sloshing. That's the correct medical term, yes? Sloshing? Around in her belly. That person, Archie, is getting older every day, and soon he will be aware enough to watch and appreciate what his mother was doing on national television the week before he was born. When I want to smile, I think of that. A week later, on the Friday before the Saturday that Amy became a mother, the entire cast stayed late to block a sketch called the Barack Obama Variety Half Hour. On a normal week, the last piece rehearsed was usually a smaller piece, with a handful of cast members cursing their luck that they had to stay at the studio until 11 p.m. the night before a show. This time, having everyone there together was a luxury and a delight. While we waited for the cameras to set up, Maya and Fred started a bit, pretending they were on stage for the 75th anniversary of SNL. Moving slowly and speaking softly, they delighted us with wooden award show banter wherein they tried to remember the lines to their old sketches. Bill Hader took the stage pretending to be his own son, and gave a speech about how much his pops had talked about working on the show before he died. We were all enjoying ourselves that night, but no one more than Amy. She was laughing the hardest, but that wasn't surprising. In my time at SNL, no one was quicker or more gracious with a laugh than Amy. Never more so than at the weekly table read when it was needed most. When a new cast member or writer had a piece bombing to such silence that you could almost hear their pores expelling sweat, you could always count on Amy to give them a laugh. Though to be fair, it was less a laugh and more of a cackle. The writer Alex Bays described it as the sound one hears when running over a raven's foot with a shopping cart. It is, without exaggeration, one of my favorite sounds on earth. We all headed home around midnight in a great mood. A quick but necessary tangent. For years, Amy has called me Coco and I have called her Moses. These nicknames sprung from a Weekend Update joke about a 6-foot-tall camel named Moses and his tiny pony sidekick Coco, who had escaped from a zoo in Texas. I don't remember the joke, but I do remember that we laughed every time we said a 6-foot-tall camel named Moses and his tiny pony sidekick Coco. At 3 a.m. or so on Saturday morning, Amy texted me, "Water broke, Coco, you're gonna do great." And that text is pretty much all you need to know about Amy. Instead of focusing on any of her fear, her excitement, or the anticipation that comes with giving birth for the first time, she sent me words of encouragement. And when I went out to do Update without her, I was glad she had. I was nervous and lonely, but I remembered that "you're gonna do great" and felt better. Amy is rarely wrong. Doing comedy for a living is, in a lot of ways, like a pony and a camel trying to escape from the zoo. It's a ridiculous endeavor and has a low probability of success. But most importantly, it is way easier if you're with a friend. So that's my chapter. I'm going to shake Amy awake now so she can continue with the hard work of reading her book for us. I hope she got some rest.
Seth?
Yeah.
Oh, God, I was having this crazy dream that you were saying nice things about me.
Aw.
It was so nice.
I was hoping you were going to run out and buy more wine.
Oh, well, I'm going to get someone to do that for us. I don't buy my own wine anymore. You know
oh,
me.
I'm so sorry.
Thank you very much, Coco, for reading that.
You're welcome, Moses.
Here's a letter that Hillary Rodham Clinton, then senator from New York, sent to Archie Ardett after he was born. October 25th, 2008. Dear Archie, happy birthday! I know that your arrival brings great joy to your parents and entire family, and I am pleased to join with them in welcoming you to New York and our nation. Best wishes for a lifetime that includes lasting friendships, boundless curiosity, a love of learning, and a future that is shining and bright. Sincerely yours, Hillary Rodham Clinton, otherwise known as your mother's double.
Figure out what you want, say it out loud, then shut up.
Birthing plan. To all caregivers, doctors, obstetrical fellows, TMZ interns, and hospital staff, we are looking forward to the birth of our child and ask that the following wishes be respected during our birth process. We have chosen to give birth in a hospital because of the outstanding facilities it makes available to us. We would also like to deliver our baby in a hospital since we spent most of our 20s getting stoned and watching episodes of ER. And so we know that delivering a baby is the best way to cheer up an attractive but beleaguered doctor. Please make sure our doctor is handsome and cares too much. We considered a home birth, but we just got our hardwood floors redone. We also considered a birthing tub, but the mother is concerned the water won't be warm enough. Is it too late to flood the hospital room or turn it into a really fun foam party? We're sorry for asking. The mother is very pregnant and would like to remind everyone her brain has turned into spaghetti. Those we plan to have present at our birth include baby, mother, father, grandparents, lawyers, agents, lottery winners, looky-loos, midwife, first wife, life coach, Fanula the doula, unexpected ghosts, bossy astrologists, and the entire cast of Cheers. All other visitors and unnecessary staff may be turned away unless they're wearing something cute or bring hot wings for the father. The birth environment is very important to us. For that reason, we ask that the lights be kept dim, noise be avoided, and the door be closed for privacy. We would also like people to stay chill and not bring their own shit into the room with them. It's really important that we feel cool. Please decorate the room with Nan Golden prints and leather beanbag chairs. We would love it if you could bring in a silk Persian rug for us to destroy. Think Chateau Marmont if it was closed for repairs. Or, I don't know, MTV Unplugged. Speaking of music, we will arrive with our own. We plan on delivering our baby to the soundtrack of Pink Floyd's The Wall while simultaneously watching The Wizard of Oz. If this kid works with us, we guarantee your minds will be blown. The mother will wear her own clothes to the birth. If the delivery is on a casual Friday, the mother will be wearing a tube top and bike shorts. Regardless of the day, the father will be in a fun tuxedo with jokey suspenders. Both the parents are in entertainment and have no business wear to speak of. Everyone else should be wearing open hospital gowns with nothing underneath. It only seems fair. We plan on handling pain in a variety of natural ways. Please have a birthing ball and back massager available upon request. An annoying nurse with an unfunny and teasing manner on whom we can focus our anger would be a welcome addition. The mother would also like a punching bag, a screaming pillow, a mirror to smash, and a small handgun. The father would like a George Foreman grill, just to have. We ask for vaginal exams only upon request. The mother requires at least a minute or two of chit-chat before cold fingers are introduced. The mother would like to remind the staff that her vagina is the absolute last thing that she wants to have touched right now. The mother can think of 1,000 things that she would rather have presently poked at than her vagina. Honestly, the mother doesn't know how the hell that baby is going to get out of there. And the mother would also like to request that the handsome doctor maintain eye contact at all times during said poking. If induction becomes necessary, we are aware of the non-chemical methods and would like to try them in this order: breast stimulation, sexual intercourse, and cervical cream. That's right, you heard us. If this baby isn't coming out, we're going to start doing it and make you all watch. So let's get cracking. We will use the squatting or semi-squatting position for pushing. Preferably, the mother would like to drop it like it's hot. The mother would like to push at her own pace. The father would like to add that he hopes it doesn't take all day. We would like to feel our son's head as he descends, with the option to stick him back up in there if we don't feel ready. The mother should be given the freedom to walk around during labor. Light choreography is expected. If drugs become necessary, we would like to go all in. We're talking epidural, helium, and roofies. The mother would like to ask one last time why no one is taking seriously her request for nitrous oxide. The mother heard about women in England and Sweden and Canada being offered this at birth, and apparently it works wonderfully to calm nerves and help with delivery. The mother still resents the judgment she received from doctors and friends when she brought up this idea. Either way, if drugs have to be administered, both mother and father know a guy. If delivery assistance is needed, we prefer suction over forceps. If episiotomy is needed, we prefer buttonhole over backstitch. If cesarean is needed, please inform us early so we don't have to go through the above first. In the event of a cesarean, the mother would like to be conscious. The mother would also not mind if you tweaked her abs while you were down there. The father would like to be present and totally freaked out when he accidentally looks past the curtain and sees his wife's organs stacked next to her like laundry. The father would like to be involved in the catching of the baby and the cutting of the cord. At least that's what he's saying right now. We'll see. Please don't cut the cord until it stops pulsing. Please immediately let the cord blood guy in with his titanium suitcase so he can put the cord blood in a vault and keep it fresh. It will help us during the robot apocalypse. After birth, we wish to nurse immediately. Please do not introduce formula or bottles or pacifiers or water unless those things stop this baby from crying. Why won't he stop crying? Wait, where is everybody going? We prefer our stay in the hospital to be extended to the longest period our insurance allows. We need time for our heads to catch up with our bodies. We also need time to catch up on some Judge Judy. Please know we are grateful and sore and happy and scared. We will hear our baby down the hall and recognize his cry, and we will realize this truly is a sci-fi miracle sent to us from G.O.D. That being said, if people buy gifts that aren't on the registry, the mother will lose her shit. The mother would like to take this moment to admit a few things. She thinks natural childbirth is amazing, but she also likes drugs. She didn't put baby oil on her perineum and try to stretch it because she just never felt like it. She lied when she said she completely stayed away from lunch meat. She also skipped Lamaze because sometimes she can't stand being around other people. That's all. We good? Thank you in advance for your support of our choices. We look forward to a wonderful birth. We are excited, but mostly scared. Have you seen the mother? She's tiny. How is this going to work exactly? Please advise.